Hello, everyone. This is Marcus from Gen Con TV, and we are excited to bring you a brand new podcast. Welcome to Fireside with Peter Adkisson, where the founder of Wizards of the Coast himself takes us on a trip through the untold history of Dungeons & Dragons, with special guests from the game's illustrious past. In today's episode, Peter and co-host Emma Larkins are joined by the co-author of D&D 3rd Edition, Jonathan Tweet. So without further ado, we'll drop you right into the conversation.
Hi there, welcome to Fireside with Peter Adkisson. I'm Peter Adkisson, my co-host is Emma Larkins, and our guest today is Jonathan Tweet. This is our very first show of a new season where we are going to explore Dungeons and Dragons, specifically the era that, well, that I was involved in, and the people I know were involved in back in the late 90s, 3rd edition, D20, the acquisition by Wizards of TSR. And so we're going to have a whole bunch of ex-wizards, or currently maybe wizards and ex-TSR people on the show. I've learned a lot of them have moved back to the Midwest, so that's going to be kind of tricky. But anyway, we are also broadcasting here from Chaldea Studios. And as you know, on this show, we go in search of the untold stories behind your favorite games. And Dungeons & Dragons is, well, that's a clear favorite for me, and I'm sure for all of you as well. Our guest today has some great stories about Dungeons & Dragons. Jonathan Tweet has a long history as an RPG designer, worked on 3rd edition, was at Wizards before the acquisition, and he's a good friend of mine. I can't wait. So, Jonathan, thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Peter. This is great.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Okay, well, what we like to do is we like to start with a little bit of, like, who was Jonathan Tweet before... Yeah. Well, let's say before being involved in Wizards of the Coast, sure. And then there's a little bit of history there before the TSR acquisition. So let's start before Wizards. You worked at a number of game companies and did some really important RPGs before we even met.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. I was part of this crew of people in Northfield, Minnesota that included Mark Reinhagen and Lisa Stevens and John Nephew. And we, especially like Mark Reinhagen and I, were the co-creators of the Ars Magica game line, and I think all those people worked on it to one degree or another.
Let's say something about Ars Magica. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's still a game that is quoted as really ahead of its time and very important. What? Why?
Yeah.
Tell us more about Ars Magica.
Right, so I think Ars Magica was one of the first games that was created by people who had grown up playing role-playing games. The first role-playing games were created by people who had grown up playing war games.
Right.
And so what Mark and I did was we really brought out more of the story in the role-playing game and sort of took it further away from its wargaming roots. And then that was in 1987, but it sort of set off this whole 90s... Renaissance in role-playing games that were more story and character oriented.
Sure, and Jonathan Tweet, of course, Mark Reinhagen, of course, would go on along with Lisa Stevens and the Wick brothers to do Vampire the Masquerade.
That's right.
So it seems like a natural evolution of that sort of a take on role-playing games. You also did Over the Edge.
Yeah, that's right. So after the business partnership broke up, between Mark Reinhagen and me, I started freelancing, and Over the Edge was the role-playing game actually that I created with the idea that I was never going to publish it.
And so the Prime Order. Got it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And since I was never going to publish it, I could make it as weird and as freeform as I wanted, and I made the kind of role-playing game that I had never played before.
Right.
And John Nephew heard about it and insisted on publishing it. I told him it was not really meant to be publishable. and he said that's what he wanted to publish was...
Yeah, and John, this was with Atlas Games.
That's John Nephew of Atlas Games. Atlas Games. That's right.
So what was it about Over the Edge? I mean, I know really the give us a taste of this sort of... Wild, weird,
Exactly. So the point of the game is I wanted people to be able to sort of start playing right away and to be able to come up with a really interesting character without having to read the rule book first. For Ars Magica, you have to read the rule book before you can do anything, before you can even start thinking about your character. Okay. So Over the Edge is, it's a modern day setting. It's on a weird fictional island where anything can happen. And so you can sort of just create whatever character you come up with out of your head.
Right.
And because it's the modern day, you can bring in all the details that you know personally from the world and anything that interests you. And because it has this sort of anything goes, you know, your character can be a psychic or, you know, be mind controlled by satellites or...
And there's a lot of conspiracy stuff,
it's all about
right?
us. Exactly.
Lots of weird conspiracy stuff happening in the book.
That's right. Yeah. So this was actually before X-Files.
Before X-Files. Wow. Right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But it had that X-Files vibe of, there are these weird things going on in the real world under the surface.
And I think that, you know, I didn't play it back in the early 90s when it was, you know, when it was content, when it came out.
Yeah, 92.
92. Yeah. But I became interested in it much later when other people that I respected started referring back to
it.
People like, Ron Edwards and designers of now that we associate with the indie RPG movement from starting in the turn of the century. Yeah. They were all looking back and saying Over the Edge was so ahead of its time and formulative. So
Vincent Baker.
Yes.
Yeah. Jason Morningstar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really, I'm really honored by how,
much
people, people sort of picked up that banner of, hey, you could do new things with role-playing games.
Right.
Right. And now they're doing things that sort of surprise me and seem a little, that's too weird. Can you do that? But it's great to see. I'm really happy to have been part of that.
Right. Right. Well, we're going to bookend the show by Over the Edge.
Yeah.
So help me remember.
All right. Fantastic.
We're going to do a callback at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did all this lead to you getting associated with Wizards of the Coast?
Right. So Lisa Stevens ended up, working at Wizards of the Coast as, I think, the first paid employee. And so she had worked
There's a rivalry between Lisa Stevens and Beverly Marshall Salem. We have to be careful. Beverly Marshall Salem was the first paid employee. Lisa was the first full-time paid employee. That's the way I understand it.
Okay,
anyway,
all right.
Yeah, so they both got some money, right? Sorry. Yes, but Lisa came out and helped and joined us in 1991.
And she had already been around, so like she knew the industry and she had contact.
Right, right, exactly.
So she knew freelancers.
Right, she knew freelancers.
Like me. And so she got in contact with me about this new cool game company she was working with in Washington State, and maybe I could do some work for it. And so I remember I took a look at the original Primal Order manuscript and but Talislantha was the big sort of my big inroad to working at Wizards of the Coast was Stephen Michael Saichi's game Talislantha.
Because when Lisa came to work for us, it was really, you know, you love it when you hire somebody, you know, you've really hired an executive when they come to you with new revenue, right? And she says, hey, you hired me, how about we pick up this game line with 14 products in inventory, and I'm like, that sounds interesting.
This is Talislantha.
Talislantha. Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about Talislantha?
Well, tell us about third edition at least. And
So the interesting thing about Talislantha is that its original game rules came out the same year as Ars Magica with sort of a similar mechanical system. And Cyberpunk came out about the same time with also a similar system. So I think there was a lot of people angling towards simplifying and streamlining the way mechanics worked. And so that was pretty interesting to see. I really liked the system in Talislantha. It's sort of a streamlined D20 system, you could say. And you folks were going to do a third edition.
Right.
And you hired me to do the introductory adventure and to bring the magic rules up to final, sort of final format.
Yeah, and that eventually led you to writing the third edition.
Then I got on the phone and I said, this game has enough issues that you should hire me to do the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I think
I started it and I was going to do an adventure. And then I said, you'd need someone to do the magic system like me, maybe.
Yeah.
And then you said, and I said, and also I could
do the whole thing
while we're at it. Right. So that was my first third edition that I ever did for Wizards of the Coast.
Right. The first third edition.
Yeah.
Right.
Was third edition of Talislantha. And it's a nice, clean little system. It's got great art. It's got a sort of a unique world.
It's a fantasy world.
All the creatures and the fantasy races are sort of one-offs. It's all like, so you don't see elves and dwarves, but you'll see
gnome kin and lizard people and the demon people or whatever. Right. And so, and they're all drawn in interesting ways. Stephen Saichi had a really good artist. And especially for the 80s, the art that came out.
Yep. P.D. Breen Black.
Thank you. That's right. So it was a really fun property to work with. You know, and the rule set was mostly done, but it hadn't been put into place for like, how is someone going to learn it? Or what's going to be the easiest way to start a campaign and all that kind of stuff that I did with the introductory adventure and whatever to sort of make it easy to get going.
We actually have someone in chat. Kathy Wapu says, I loved Talislanta.
Oh, hi, Kathy. I love Kathy. Yeah, that's great.
Hey, Kathy.
Yeah. So one other game system to touch on briefly before we get to D&D is Everway.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So when I came to Wizards of the Coast, I had two game pitches, and one was a new agey, fancy, image-oriented, kind of spiritual, multicultural game, and the other was sort of a face-to-face martial arts brawling fighting game.
Right.
And people really loved the new agey game, and that turned out to be Everway. And the idea is you create your character based on image cards that you pick so that you, instead of reading a book to try to figure out what your character is, you look at these cards and you come up with these stories. And in the same way that Over the Edge is set up where you can create whatever character you want because it's anything goes, Everway is set up to be you can create whatever you want because these people travel from world to world. So if you want to be from Ice World, you can your friend can create someone who's from Desert World and you can adventure together and you don't have to worry about finding a place on a map for your character to come from because there are all these worlds across the universe that you could hail from.
Right. Great. So you started you started at Wizards what year?
So I was hired on the end of 93. I didn't move out till 94.
Okay. So And while you were there, you went to Talislanta and then Everway. Let's fast forward to one other thing. Let's fast forward to D&D.
Sure.
I know you also did some work on Magic, but let's get to D&D.
Netrunner.
Yep. Magic Netrunner. Yes. So I remember what I was going through in this period of time, which was trying to figure out how we should grow and how intelligent ways to spend money other than giving it back to shareholders. And so we came up on the idea, on the opportunity to acquire TSR and Dungeons & Dragons in 1997.
Yeah,
I always say every date with a question mark because the memory is getting a little fuzzy after all these years.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's go to that moment. When did you first hear that this might be in the works, that we might be at Wizards? Because we were good friends by this time.
Yeah.
We might be acquiring TSR and Dungeons & Dragons. And what was your reaction to that? Or do you have some thoughts about that moment?
I was not on the inside track. So I heard about it, but I think I heard about it when pretty much everybody heard about it. In 95, you had cut my Everway line and we laid off everyone that was reporting to me. And now 2 years later, we're going to buy somebody else's role-playing game. Yes. That's fine. I think those were both smart moves.
Well, it's a tough decision. Well, you know, I remember saying when we had to close down our RPG efforts, Everway and Slay Industries and other RPGs we were doing. Yep. We even did Ars Magica?
Ars Magica, that's right.
I had just come to the conclusion there was no way you could make money in this category unless you had the number one game in the category, which at that's the time was D&D, maybe Vampire and Masquerade. Right. But So we had the chance to get D&D. It was like, well, okay, we're back in role-playing game business now.
Let's there you go.
Let's go back in. Yeah. So did you have some thoughts of what you might, like did you like suddenly get oh, wow, it's D&D. Huh, I wonder what I could do with D&D. Like what?
Yeah, so...
And you'd done some freelance work on D&D, is that right?
I had done freelance work for D&D, right? Well, I've been playing D&D, started in 77...
Okay.
A
year before me. Fine.
Okay, fine. It was the very end of 77.
Okay.
So I might not have played.
I was actually the end of 78 too, so that's okay. Okay.
Yeah. And like I hacked D&D from the ground up for the campaign that I ran in
high school.
And so I sort of was already used to messing with the D&D rules.
Right.
But what I figured I would do is I would work on some ancillary product, like a D&D style game for the Dominia setting that Magic is in.
Right.
I didn't think that I was going to work on the core
right.
Rules. Also because wasn't clear what that would look like. Mm. Right. Like that's a really daunting task to take this, you know, big story game and change it in a way that people are going to accept.
Right. Well, and I remember you being one of my few allies in the idea of doing a Dominaria, Magic the Gathering setting as a setting for D&D. And in fact, when I had to present to the Wizards Board of Directors the idea of acquiring TSR, I listed that as one of the synergies.
Right.
Like, hey, we could take these two lines and cross them over. We could do a role-playing, a D&D setting set in Dominaria.
Yeah.
And, boy, that went down like a turd in church, let me tell you. I was like there were not very many people. Nobody on the Magic team wanted to be associated with D&D, and nobody from TSR wanted to be associated. I shouldn't say associated with. That makes it sound like nobody wanted to even do lunch. But I mean, like, nobody wanted the brands to cross.
Right.
But you had, before we had to face that.
Yeah. I thought it was a great idea.
You thought it was a great idea. I got to play test. We were
play testing different versions, a board game kind of version where you would like go into a dungeon and try to take down the portals to Phyrexia or whatever.
Ooh, right,
right. Right. That seemed pretty cool. And
I found it, when we were doing that, I found it really, I was doing some play testing even in my own Chaldea game at the time. I thought it was very inspirational.
Yeah.
To look at a magic card
and
see the magic abilities of a creature or an artifact, and then kind of try and translate that into Dungeons and Dragons terms.
That's right.
Like just having that kicker to kind of point you in a direction made it so much fun to work on.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that the magic powers, when a creature has a power in magic, it's an interesting power that's worth the type. Right? Like, it wouldn't be on that card unless it meant something. But a lot of D&D creatures were sort of built sort of like, well, what would a 7-foot-tall ogre be like? Well, it would probably have these stats. And it's not interesting. It's just like, well, whatever. Now you've got a 7-foot-tall ogre and that's your... Right?
Right.
And so you're right that Dominia had these interesting creatures with abilities that made you wonder about them, like the kobolds, where you'd have a kobold sergeant would give the kobold masses these
bonus
abilities,
and slivers and all sorts of crazy wacky things. Yeah, it was a sad moment when I eventually decided, well, let's kill that line too.
Yeah, well,
oh my gosh. So we acquired TSR.
Yep.
We gave job offers to most everybody that was associated with TSR. Most of them accepted and moved out to Seattle. Do you remember did you forge any friendships, or do you remember anybody you were excited to meet that had been involved in D&D or any?
It was a pretty strange onboarding, I have to say, right? Like, because they came over sort of as a group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a big enough group that they didn't have to mingle. And there was definitely a split. There was the card side of R&D and there's a role-playing side of R&D, and the cultures were different.
Right.
And the interests were different and the people were different and the history was different. And so...
It was hard to kind of make those relationships.
Yeah, it was pretty hard. I got into like a game... on lunches, like a 1 hour every Friday dungeon lunch that one of the old timers ran. So I got to like hang out with some of the people there but it wasn't until sort of I ended up on the team and proved what I could do that people took me seriously and
Yeah.
And where were they coming from?
Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yep, the home.
So a very change of big change of scenery too.
The original home of Dungeons and Dragons in Lake Geneva. Yeah. And some of them moved back there, you know, like Skip Williams lives there now, I think, and a bunch of others.
Yep, Sue Wyland.
Yeah. And, you know, and they all have reasons to get together and reminisce because Gary Gygax's son, Luke, runs GaryCon there now. And I go there once in a while. It's great. Anyway, so, very quickly after acquiring TSR, we announced that we were going to do a third edition Dungeons and Dragons. Almost immediately, like almost day one.
And what did people think about that?
Oh, I think there was. I think everybody was pretty receptive to the idea.
So I've got the answer to that question.
Okay.
So, and I hope you can back this up.
Okay, well, I'll try. Right. We'll see.
That if you talked with D&D players, do you want a third edition? They'd be like, no, right? Because they already had to switch to second edition. It wasn't worth switching. Didn't make the game all that much better.
And that was only 12 years earlier.
And they did not want to do that again, right? And so, but then if you would say, well, if we had to do a third edition, are there any changes you would make? And then they would list all the problems with the game and all the things that needed to be fixed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you heard what they said, no, they didn't want an edition. Mm. But if you listened, they were ready for a new edition.
Right. So obviously I really wanted the TSR people who moved out to be really involved in making third edition. Yeah. So we organized a third edition design team. Original design members were Skip Williams, Rich Baker, Monty Cook, who's going to be my guest here in a couple of weeks.
Good.
So that'll be great. And the acquisition of TSR came with Ryan Dancy.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
who had brokered.
Right.
Played a strategic role in brokering the whole deal to acquire TSR. And so we'll get into that in a couple of weeks. It was funny because I told Ryan, I said, okay, listen. And I put him in charge of running the brand of Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes. And I told Ryan right off the bat, I said, okay, I'm going to put you in charge of running the brand of Dungeons & Dragons, but you're not going to have anything to do with third edition. I'm going to form a design team, and they're going to report directly to me because I have a lot of opinions about how I want this game to go.
And you did.
Yeah, I did have a lot of opinions. Well, I'd started working a year later, 1978, started playing Dungeons & Dragons. Yeah. And, you know, I had 20 years of house rules.
Right, you had hacked it. You hacked it more than I did, I think.
Hacked it a lot because I just refused to give up on it. And so at some point, but you weren't involved in that at first.
That's
right. You pitched a couple other ideas for D&D or for TSR style games So tell us about that.
There was
a Gamma World something.
Exactly. Already? So I, like I said, you know, I was on the margins. I was working on the fringes.
Right.
And so I was doing this Dominia stuff, whatever, not part of the main line.
Right.
And then Lisa Stevens was there and she was in charge of the Odyssey line, which was sort of like the, you know, weird D&D settings that there's no real reason for. And so you put them in this separate line.
Right.
Right? Okay. Like, my response would be, maybe don't do them. But anyway, there was this line of sort of these weird one-off settings, and I pitched Gamma World.
Okay.
Right? Like, I always liked Gamma World as sort of the second coolest thing that TSR did, and you could use the D20 rules.
Right.
They weren't called that yet.
Right,
but
you could
use the Dungeons & Dragons rules and create a pretty...
Right.
Cool version of Gamma World that has mutants. This is like post-apocalypse, right?
Right.
So it's mutants and lasers and whatever. And all that stuff is good in D&D, right?
I loved mutations.
Yeah.
The best part of Gamma World was the random mutations chart.
Mutations.
There's places where you could go and wander into like heavy radioactive zone, which did not mean you died of radiation poisoning.
Right.
It meant you rolled percentile dice and got some special ability.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe it's a defect. Maybe it's another leg. Maybe it's, laser eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, But so it was like, it's like D&D, but with mutations and bat wings and laser eyes and electric teeth and like
and controlling magnetic lines of flux.
Imagine all sorts of going up
against a knight with that.
So sort of to my surprise, we got the go-ahead. It was in this weird line that no one cared about. So then when Ryan Dancy took over, his big thing was to get people focused back on core D&D, okay. right? Like he took a book that was for the Ravenloft setting,
right.
and he said, well, why don't we pull the Ravenloft label off the front? And now it's a D&D book instead of a Ravenloft book, and it sold better than all the other Ravenloft books because it didn't have Ravenloft on it, right? Hmm. So his thing is, let's all go back to the core D&D experience, and I went to him with my cool pitch, and he said he wouldn't do it in a million years. And I think he was right. Like, you know, in the world where there, AD&D has a whole bunch of lines that all compete with each other, and we're creating these settings just because they seem cool, even though they're not part of any logical business plan, then the Gamma World makes sense in that business model.
Yeah.
But in the business model where we're trying to get people back to buying D&D products,
Gamma World
doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
So he was right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's funny because this conversation is a lot of like game designers out there. You should know this is what it's like to be a game designer. You work on a line, it gets canceled. You work on a little line, it gets canceled.
Yeah, that is right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the way it is. So I'm going to tread carefully here because what happens with third edition is that we had some very talented people on the team.
Yeah.
Worked a lot of heart and soul, but I wasn't happy, to be honest. Like, I was having trouble getting a nice connection with them and where I wanted it to go.
Yeah.
So kind of glossing over that. And at some point, I said, okay, I need to put in my ringer. And so that had to have been awkward. I threw you into the D&D 3rd edition design team with a bunch of TSR guys who'd worked on Dungeons & Dragons there for career spanning. Epic.
That's right.
And so,
and who needed to prove themselves because their whole company had gone under, and now they had to show that it wasn't their fault that it went under. Like, they knew what they were doing. So there was a lot emotionally and professionally. Yeah. There was a lot on the line.
Hmm. Right, right. So how'd that go?
Well, what was your role or position? Or what was your purpose?
Thanks, Emma.
Right, so the three of them had no leader among them. It was a troika, right? Mm-hmm. I was going to do an introductory basic set, right? That's one of the things that I've worked on for years and years. Mm. So that was my beginning. But then it was the beginning of my official involvement and how I got to know the guys. But then at one point, their boss brought me into his office and said I was the fourth person on the team, mm-hmm. which is, you know, now it's even more awkward because with no leader, among three people, that's hard. Mm-hmm. Among four people, even harder, right? And plus, who is this? And I'm clearly the outsider, right? So it was awkward. But we were there to make the game better, right? And we were professionals. We're professionals, and so we worked on it, and I could see that they knew what they were doing, and they could see that I knew what we were doing.
And you told me one story when we were talking about this that I think is a good story to tell here. At one point, Skip Williams really kind of helped you get in a little bit.
He did. He did that twice.
And for anybody watching who doesn't know, I mean, Skip Williams is a legend.
He goes way back early.
I think he started working at TSR when he was 3 years old or something like that.
So he worked on the monster and treasure assortments that were in my basic set in 1977.
Right.
So he was there, making my dungeon possible.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was the sage for the longest time.
In Dragon Magazine.
So he'd answer all the terrible questions, right? Like, is it pronounced Flind or Flind, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he... He, so to have his backing was good. He was the first to sort of back my core system. Like, I had already come up with what's the core system for D&D for my Dominia games, right? Mm-hmm. You roll a 20-sided die and you add a bonus for how good you are on your stats, and you add a bonus for your class and level, and that's you try to hit a target number or higher, right?
Yeah. So I've already... The target number being the opponent's armor class.
If you're attacking, make an attack roll, or the difficulty class for the door, how tough is the door, you're trying to make a die roll, it's all this, right? And so I had already sort of come up with that system.
Right.
And they had a very different system that they were floating. Mm-hmm. And Skip was the first one to say, you know, my system was worth taking a look at and trying. Right. And it turned out to be the system that we went with. So that was good. And then he helped me again when we were doing, I was proposing cyclic initiative because in the game rules.
So let's break down cyclic initiative.
Let's break down cyclic initiative.
I think our audience would love us to dive into a mechanic.
Yeah. It's a great story.
Third edition.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's give the mechanic guys and gals a.
Right. Okay.
A little thing.
So you played a lot more whatever second than
I
did.
I could set this up really well.
Okay.
Like,
yeah. Go ahead.
AD&D.
Yeah.
You try to, the initiative surprise rules with the weapon speeds and speed factors was incomprehensible. In fact, I've actually recently had a hankering to try and actually figure it out. Because everybody...
And you were something like a computer guy, right?
I was a computer guy.
If you can't figure it out...
And I couldn't figure it out. And so what's funny is, recently out in just last week, I was out in the Midwest with Jeff Martin, True Dungeon fame.
Okay,
And he played a ton of AD&D. And so I asked him, you're a guru of AD&D.
Yeah.
Explain to me how initiative worked in AD&D. And he just kind of rolled his eyes and says, nobody knows. I said, wait, what? Nobody played the way it was in AD&D.
Right.
So by the way, if you're watching and you can explain the AD&D initiative system, the way it's in the rules, not your house rules,
not your house
for
rules.
It, because that's too easy. Like, like really how it worked according to the way it was in Gary's mind.
Yeah.
Tell me. That.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, so that's what D&D was.
Right. And one of the key features there is that you would roll initiative every round.
Right.
So some rounds you would go first, sometimes you would go last. So that means your character might go twice in a row. If you go last one round and first the next round,
that sounds kind of fun.
It does sound kind of fun. Like on paper, it seems great. Yeah. Right. And there's also sort of like this decorations phase where everyone declares what they're going to do before they see how the dice roll, so that I might declare that I'm going to run across the room and kick open the door, but by the time my turn actually happens, I realize, I wish that instead I was running over there to heal them, but I already declared I'm running over there. Right. So you do that. That also sounds great.
That sounds cool because it sounds kind of realistic. I want to do this. No. Yeah. That's why I did house rules, is because I used to do big scale D&D fights.
Okay,
I
remember
50, 60 miniatures
out on the table.
And you couldn't do declarations for what 50 characters are going to do. Right. I mean, you could, Anyway.
So, the way that I learned out of that basic box was you just went in order of who had the highest dexterity. And so you would just always go in a circle.
Yeah.
Right? Highest dexterity first every time. It was really fast. Everyone knew what order you went in.
Right.
And this whole business of rolling every round, then it takes forever to go through the round because no one knows who's next. People get dropped. Like on paper, it seems interesting because you're forced to make decisions ahead of time. You have to adapt to the situations as they change. It sounds great.
Mm. Right.
But then when you actually play, it's slow. People are sitting around. Whose turn is it? Wait. Oh, I should have done it. Oh,
except that never happens because nobody plays that way. Everybody just has their house rules.
So everyone just has their house rules.
Right.
So, So I sort of said to the group, I really want to try this cyclical initiative. It's always seemed to work for me. It's like, it's what I had tried in the playtest with Dominaria and whatever.
Right.
But it's so different from what was written in the rules.
And so different than from AD&D.
From AD&D.
Or second edition AD&D. Hmm. Right.
And so I was like, but you know what? It's probably just so different that even if it's better, people would not like it. And Skip said, well, let's try it.
Right.
And we played one battle using initiative that goes around in a circle instead of being different every round.
Right.
And it was like just so much faster.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it feels more like combat because it's faster. And so now you're having this much fun in this much time.
Yeah.
Well, that's better. Right. It means that by the end of the turn, at the end of the 5 hours you've been playing D&D, you've had way more fun just because things have gone faster.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was one of the big things that really, that I learned from that experience is how well people took to a rule that on paper they rejected, but in practice they saw how well it played.
Right.
And speed really is part of that. Just that having things happen faster.
Right.
Playtesting. Turns out it works.
Playtesting turns out to be really valuable.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay, let's stay on mechanics for a moment.
Yeah.
What other interesting stories can we drum up about, how you left your fingerprints on third edition?
Well, there's the grapple rules.
Which all the Pathfinder fans say the grapple rules suck in third edition.
Well, that's why I bring them up, right?
You mean
messiest,
third edition is not perfect?
The grapple rules are the messiest, most complicated, whatever. Like, what my overriding design goal for the grapple rules was, I didn't want grappling to be so good that you would discover that it turns out to be the best option. And now it's like, oh, the orcs, instead of hitting you with your sword, they're all grappling you. And now the game, it's like, oh, yeah, that actually makes sense because of the way the rules work. Yeah. And so it had to really be punishing unless you got everything right. It couldn't just be the sort of thing where, oh, I happen to get these 2 feats and now I'm going to grapple everything from now on. And
right.
It's, and then
grapple the dragon, grapple the yeti, grapple the halfling. It's like sumo D&D.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm like, there was a problem with the, unarmed combat rules, in second edition where you could have a pretty good chance of knocking somebody out flat if you had a high strength and you were fighting unarmed. So it's like, oh, they've got 100 hit points. Well, the best thing to do is punch them. Because you've got a 1 in 8 chance of just knocking them out.
Knocking them out.
And so I wanted to avoid that. And I did. The grappling rules are so punishing that people are not going to make the mistake of using them instead of fighting with a sword.
So there's a design trick. If there's a certain part of the game you don't want players to engage in with too much, just kind of botch the rules a little bit.
Yeah. Don't make it easy for
them.
I'm glad
I didn't know this at the time. Yeah. I think that's all reasonable. That's all reasonable.
So I did finally, I got punished myself though in a game of third edition where there was a little imp that was bothering us and I didn't have the magic weapon I needed. And I thought, well, it's tiny, it's small. I'll just use the grappling rules.
Right.
Like I'll just grab it and then it can't fly away. And so sure enough, it's so small and weak, whatever. My character grabbed it. I felt really good. And then it uses the escape artist trait because I also said that demons have a ton of skill points.
Yeah.
And so all the demons just have so actually that made perfect sense that I tried to grab this thing. It didn't work because it's a screwy demon and they're really good at getting away from you.
Yeah. Right.
So there I go. I got punished by my own grappling rules.
Yeah. Well, it just warms my heart.
And I felt like that's how it should be.
Yeah.
I did the rules right. I failed just like I was supposed to.
Right. So I think there was also an interesting, I remember a lot of discussions and Scaff jumped in on discussions about facing, when you played AD&D,
that's another really good one.
Your miniatures had a facing, which you mean, like in third edition, I don't think fifth edition has facing. We won't talk about fourth edition on this show. facing was a thing way back in the day. And we got rid of facing.
That's right.
So tell us about that. How did that happen?
I'm not clear what the second edition facing rules are either. I think that's a lot like initiative. I think people do it different ways.
I don't know either. I only bothered with the odd numbered editions of D&D.
Okay. All right. So we wanted the rules for combat to be so clear that people would play them the same way.
Right.
And that way you can balance the game. You can't balance the game if these people are playing that way and those people are playing another way.
Right.
You can't do organized play if in every city they play different.
So
things had to be formalized.
Well, yeah. And I want to interject here, too. Yeah. One of my goals with third edition D&D is that I wanted to make the rules, bring them forward, make them up. I always get so...
Yeah.
I get so frustrated with people saying, well, AD&D is so much easier. bull. Yeah. It's not easier. Right. It's not easier. If it's easier for you, it's because you're not playing with all the rules and you threw it. So AD&D would make the rules easier by hiding.
That's right.
Hiding a lot of the stuff in the DMG stuff. So So.
And what we wanted everyone to play the same way, and that meant you had to know what the actual rules were. And so we were pretty well in your face with what the rules were.
Right.
But so we had to figure out facing. We couldn't hand wave it. Right. It had to really work.
Right.
And the worst thing about facing is if my miniature is sitting on a map facing a direction, you could take your miniature and sort of walk them around behind me and then hit me from behind. Mm. And that seems weird, right? Like you wouldn't see that in a movie.
Because you get a bonus for striking from behind.
You get a bonus from
in AD&D, there was bonuses for striking on the flank.
Yeah.
Bigger bonus for flanking, striking from the rear. Yeah. You had to worry about which side somebody's shield was on.
That's
if they had a shield, because their armor class for the shield bonus was only on that side.
Yeah.
That's right.
If you really dug into rules, you'd find that. But
That's right. So if you want to avoid somebody going around the back to backstab somebody, like just doing a do-si-do around them or whatever, you can say that on somebody else's turn, I can turn to face them, and that's reasonable. But what if there's already other people, multiple people are attacking me? Can I spin every time? What if I turn my back to somebody? So we had this, maybe there'll be like an attack of opportunity. If someone comes to me, so I turn to face them, and then I expose my back to you, then maybe you get an attack of opportunity against me at a bonus, pretty complicated. Pretty complicated.
Well, I remember we tried to design those rules.
Yes.
We experimented.
We played them. Yeah.
Facing rules during third edition D&D. And it was a mess.
And there was also a version where you could sort of walk away from one character and go over and hit the other.
Right.
And so like if you were fighting four ogres, everyone would swarm on one ogre.
Right.
And fight that ogre. Then everyone swarm on the other ogre. Right. Because there was no.
If they were smart. Players weren't that smart. But
That's right. And we played with. We wanted a game that would stand up to rough play. We wanted.
We wanted people
who were going to take it seriously and push and try to win. And Scaff was really great for that. And you were great for that.
Right. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Right. You want to win.
Right.
And so. We introduced the attack of opportunity rules to try to, which I think worked out pretty well.
I like the OP rules.
Right? Yeah. So it's like, you can ignore that person if you want, but then you suffer a swing, right? And then maybe you care, maybe you don't. So it seems really good. But luckily, Scaff was working on sort of a board game version of Dungeons & Dragons, and they needed to simplify things. So they were taking what we were doing on 3rd edition and trying to simplify them even, streamline them even more to come up with a fast board game experience. And the rule that they came up with for flanking was the 3rd edition rule for flanking, which is if you bookend somebody, then each of you bookending them gets a bonus.
Meaning two characters attacking somebody from opposite sides.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that worked out great.
Yeah, which meant that, and the result of that is we just threw out facing all the
time. You don't have to worry about facing.
There's no facing.
You don't worry about where the shield is or all that kind of stuff. It's so much easier.
So much easier.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it sounds like you were playing with minis a lot of the time. I don't know as much what it was like back then, but I know for me, like, people aren't always playing with minis.
That's right.
So if you don't have a mini, it probably becomes even harder. It's like, where are you facing?
Exactly. Whereas the flanking, you can sort of picture that in your head, right?
Well, and I think it's fair to say that before 3rd edition, people were playing with miniatures even less, percentage-wise.
That's right.
Interesting.
Like, it was D&D, AD&D, 2nd edition AD&D had a higher percentage of sort of theater of the mind sort of attitude.
I think that's right.
That people, you know, you're not really on a hex grid. You're not really trying, or square grid. You're not necessarily using miniatures and all that tactical stuff.
I mean, the moving rules.
It's in the rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was. But we really wanted to codify it and have it hold up as a miniatures game. And part of it was this initiative that we wanted to have a D&D miniatures game, which we eventually ended up not really doing.
Right.
Another game line canceled.
That's right. But we did D&D miniatures, right? Yeah, we did metal miniatures, and we did chainmail miniatures, and then plastic miniatures.
But eventually it was just to play D&D with.
To
do a thing. So somewhere during all that, you ended up being the lead designer for 3rd edition.
You handled that pretty pretty subtly.
Yeah.
Where you set yourself up as the lead designer for a while when the playtest version of the rules was not up to your standards. And you sort of came in to get us all marching in the right direction. And I think that's right. And then when you backed off, because you were also running the company, you left somebody for the left somebody in charge where, there, like I said, it had been the four of us and no one in charge.
Right.
That's really hard to decide which rule to put in the playtest packet.
Right. So it had to be somebody to break the ties. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and then people didn't mind me so much being in charge because at least it wasn't you. Right. And so that made it so much more acceptable. Whereas if you had just put me in charge, then they would have resented it.
Yeah.
Huh. Better than Peter.
He's smart, right? Yeah.
More like tricky, I think.
Cunning.
Tricksy.
Cunning. Yeah.
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 Well, resourceful.
I felt like we had such a pretty clear idea of things we wanted to do. You know, I remember one of the things that I thought was really important about third edition D&D is that we wanted to move from a system of things you can't do to things you can do.
That's right.
And by the way, I'm sitting here. I'm saying a lot of bad things about AD&D today, and I want everybody to know. Listen, I loved AD. I mean, AD&D. Even Richard Garfield even said that AD&D was probably, or D&D was the most innovative game ever designed in terms of what games were before D&D and what D&D added to that. Yeah. So I'm full of praise and love for D&D and AD&D at the same time. You know, we're like, okay, this is great. Now we got to change all this stuff, right?
That's right.
But in AD&D, there were a lot of things like, oh, you're a dwarf. You can't be a magic user.
You know, can only go this high in a level.
You don't have these many levels. You could, you know. You
can't multi-class in that combination. You can only multi-class in these combinations. Hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I one of the guiding lights that I put in place for third edition D&D is I want to be a game that you can do whatever you want to do. And I the first piece of original art I bought for D&D was the Dragon Magazine cover. Yeah. The first Dragon Magazine that talked about third edition D&D had the cover was a half-orc paladin.
Yeah, that's right.
And to me, that's what that's what represented what third edition was going to be, right? So when you look back on working on third edition, because the time flies. We're near the end of our hour. So how do you feel about it now, 20 years later? Do you feel really proud of it?
I feel great about it. I feel great about it. You know, are there things that we would have done differently if we? Sure. Mm. But
another year of playtesting. Right.
And there are some big things that I think we missed, like spell casting balance and cleric balance. But people loved it, right? Like it did so much with combined with the D20 or whatever. It did so much for helping people see how the game works and how the numbers work and what they mean so that they can invent their own stuff, so they can invent their own D20 stuff, so they can invent other games inspired by how the math works in third edition. I think it just was really, really strong, and it just was an exciting version of Dungeons & Dragons. It was very, like, we really wanted to make Dungeons & Dragons seem super cool. Like, so we went back to the sort of that first edition vibe where stuff was a little bit edgy and cool, a little spiky, right? I'm really happy with it. The sort of small amount of world building that gets implied in what little kind of content there is there, like the race descriptions or the alignment descriptions, I think it was really good. And I think it, you know, paved the way for fifth edition, right? Like third edition streamlined stuff enough that you can then get a handle on things and streamline it even more, which is, I think, what they did with fifth.
So you pretty positive about fifth?
I am positive about fifth. I would not play it for fun.
Oh, Jonathan.
I mean, I wouldn't play third edition for fun anymore. Like, I think... Right, so, first of all, it's so much slower than a game like Everway. In Everway, you can resolve a conflict with one draw off from the fortune deck, and you get this card, and you interpret some event, and now you whatever. And D&D, it's like, all right, well, now you roll on a 20-sided die. Oh, you hit. All right, you roll some damage. You got 7 damage. People cheer. Yay, 7 damage. It's like, well, it just takes forever. And then the balance in D&D is weird because some classes have per day abilities and some pretty much don't. And really what determines how powerful you are is how many rests you get. Yeah. And so that, you know, it's not for me satisfying to play a long combat and know that, well, what really matters is not how well we do in this combat, but whether we can convince the game master to let us rest afterwards. If we can convince the game master to let us rest afterwards, it doesn't matter how we do in this fight because we'll just re-up all our abilities. It'll be fine. Right. And so now whether I rolled 7 damage or 9 damage doesn't matter anyway because we're going to rest after this battle. And so there's, you know, it's just like I have just played D&D.
You just took me back to whole WotC D&D, R&D conversation.
Right? Yeah. So it's just, you know, I have played D&D enough that I have gazed into its inner workings.
Yeah.
And I see how it works, and it's hard for me to be playing in a D&D combat and get into it and not be looking at it and thinking about
meta.
This is not the like whether I rolled 7 on that damage die or not, it's not that exciting. It's not interesting enough. I want more to come out of a die roll. So like in Powered by the Apocalypse games, something happens every time you roll the dice, right? Yeah. There's never a happens result, which is you get half the time in D&D, it seems like. And so I just want more action. It's like this, it's like the initiative thing again. I want things to happen faster. Right. And D&D is slow.
So this show is also about Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah.
You know, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Just thinking back to your time at Wizards, you know, how do you it was crazy times.
It was crazy times.
The '90s.
Like, it was like 3 separate crazy times. Right, because sort of before 95 was one kind of crazy, and then 95 to 97 was another kind of crazy, and 97 to 2000 wasn't, and like it was getting bought.
So looking back, what do you Altoids?
My bad.
What do you take with you from that, from those years, for your time at Wizards? What have you look back and say, you know, but I really, is that too corny of a question for you?
Like, what's your takeaway?
What's your takeaway?
I feel like I learned a lot about game design in that whole process. Yeah. Like, I'm revising Everway, and I know a lot more about game design than I did in 95. And, you know, the way that the R&D crowd would break down games and analyze them and, you know, was really
pretty brutal at times.
Yeah, brutal and informative. And so I feel as though I learned a lot. I learned a lot of things not to do.
Right.
That is also true. Right. There are a lot of lessons learned.
All right. So let's, before we close, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about what have you been doing since started this
D&D?
Yeah,
we also mentioned bookending.
Yes.
Remember, we mentioned something earlier in the show we're going to come back to.
Okay, so before we come back to that, I want to say the time that I was working on third edition at home, I was working on Grandmother Fish. And that was a child's book on evolution that was inspired by my daughter who was born in 94. So I was working on a book that would teach evolution to preschoolers, and it took me 15 years. I finally got it right, and now Macmillan has published it, and it's in Chinese and Japanese and Italian. Wow. Yeah, wow. And so it is the first book to teach evolution to preschoolers, and kids really like it. And so that is sort of my completely parallel life, right?
Yeah. I knew that you had done this. I didn't realize you'd started that long ago.
Yeah, that's right. Because when my daughter Tessa was little, there was no book like this for her. So I figured I needed to write it.
All right. So, what else have you been doing? What are you up to now? Designing any games recently?
Yeah. So last year, Over the Edge, debuted. And so this is the game that I did in 92, and it was supposed to be unpublishable.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And I honestly, I had a very freeform combat system that I played in my personal campaign, but I had no way of expressing how to make that work to someone else who would run the game. So I had I came up with sort of like a hacked system where you make attack rolls versus defense rolls and you deal damage and you have hit points, and it's a lot like D&D. And so when I came back to the game to redo it, I overhauled the system. And now, sort of like with Everway, where you, in Everway you can resolve a conflict with a single draw from the fortune deck, in Over the Edge you have a pair of dice that are the dice you roll for every big conflict, and you cast those lots, and that can be make or break for you on whatever conflict that you have underway. And so it plays super fast.
Right.
And like you had mentioned, how when you're playing sort of a new style role-playing game, a story-oriented role-playing game, you can't just throw monsters at the party while you think about what's going to happen next.
Right.
Like and that's what happens with Over the Edge, is that the combats go so fast that you just get in twice as much campaigning in a session as with the old version.
So the third edition Over the Edge, it's out.
It's Atlas, by Atlas.
By Atlas Games.
That's right. Full color, and big map.
Nice. Yep. Nice. And check it out there.
That's right.
That's great. Well, fantastic.
Yeah.
Are there any last parting words? Anything else you want to say?
Any
last words?
See you at Gen Con.
Well, best 4 days in gaming.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's
so
great.
Ton of fun.
Thanks to our guest, Jonathan Tweet. Thanks to Emma Larkins for being our co-host. Thank you all for joining me. It's great to be with you, and we'll see you next week.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Fireside with Peter Adkison. If you want to catch the show live, be sure to tune in every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific on twitch.tv/GenConTV. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date on all the Fireside podcast happenings. We'll be back every Monday with classic episodes of Fireside covering the history of Magic the Gathering, and every Friday with a new episode of Fireside Dungeons & Dragons. Again, I've been Marcus from GenConTV. Thank you for listening. And we will see you soon.